The recording has started.
Thank you very much. So this is our third session of Thursday, April 23rd, from the Cross Community Working Group Accountability. And I am delighted to welcome you to this three-hour marathon for our intense session. Before we start, I would like to do a roll call, as we usually do. So, as usual, we will rely on the Adobe Connect list of participants. And if there is any colleague who is on audio only, please make yourself heard so we can add you to the participant list.
Hi, this is Michael Clark from Sidley. I'm here with Holly Gregory, but I'm not in the chat room yet in Adobe.
Thank you very much.
Matthew, this is Leon. I am not at in the Adobe Connect room at the moment. I will be in short, but just to make myself heard, I'm not on the Adobe Connect room at the moment.
Excellent, Leon. Thank you. So with that formality, I would move to our agenda tonight, or today, or whatever the time of day it is for you. We are going to focus this session on the Work Party 2 items, which we will review thoroughly. But before that, just a quick recap of where we were with Session 2. Some of you may have noticed we have not yet turned around the updated version of the document we worked on in Session 2, which was basically on the board recall. That is due to some issues we have encountered with the notes. If you were in the AC room, you remember there were some weird things with the notes. And so staff has been fixing this in the meantime. So we've experiencing a slight delay on the turnaround of the document, but I will come shortly. I would also like to draw your attention on a paper that was circulated a couple of hours ago coming from Legal Advice. It is an executive summary on the various membership designator, sort of various community mechanisms. It is a very high-quality document, easy to read. I strongly encourage everyone to read it. And that's going to be one of the supporting material for a session we'll have tomorrow. Session 2 was about the board recall. We would have some items that we will take on board for further discussions tomorrow, essentially on the NOMCOM proposal as well as the thresholds. But we've had a very constructive discussion, which shows that we certainly have ways forward to move on to public comments after our intense session. So after two quite constructive and productive sessions today, this third session will review Work Party 2, as I was saying. And for that purpose, I am now turning to Thomas, who will manage the first sections of Work Party 2 work. Thomas, you have the floor.
Yes, but actually, Mathieu, I think we've swapped this in the prep and allocated these 2 points to Leon, if I'm not mistaken. No, sorry, my fault, my bad. Let me just briefly add to your opening remarks that we have planned to have a five-minute break halfway through this meeting so that everybody has the opportunity to stretch their legs or do other things that you might wish to do after 90 minutes. So with that, I think we can move to discussing sections 6.2 and 6.3, the mission commitment core values fundamental commitments. For those points, you will remember that we did have substantive discussions on those points, both in Istanbul as well as during the meeting number 20 on the 31st of March. So we would like to spare the group going through each and every detail of that, but rather confirm that what we see in the report is in line with everybody's thinking, and ask for comments or objections from the group. But before we do so, I would like to give the rapporteur, Becky Burr, the opportunity to add anything to in terms of opening remarks to set the scene for the discussion. Becky.
Thank you. This document has been relatively stable. We have made changes since Istanbul, although largely the point of the changes has been to provide an easy-to-use comparison document to reflect the source of the changes and to highlight the changes from the existing bylaws and to annotate them to show what affirmation of commitments provision is addressed by the language. So the chart that's in starts on page 19 of the text, and then on page 21, the fundamental commitments and core values, which starts on 21, have been annotated essentially to describe the sources and to show clearly any changes in language from the current language. I just circulated another copy of this chart with a very small number of changes in purple ink, that there are no changes in the mission and core values, but if you look at the next page, there's not in the mission statement, but in the fundamental commitments and core values, I have put in purple font the language from Work Party One's work on the affirmation of commitments, and you can see that those minor changes in purple, and that corresponds to the language that has been in the that is in the frozen draft on beginning on page 44. So with that, I don't think that there are any material, you know, changes from the document that has been in circulation for a while now.
Thank you very much, Becky. That's very helpful. Let's now open it up for questions or comments. Alan.
Thank you. It's an issue I raised a long time ago, and I just let drop, but I realize it's still there. There's a reference in at the beginning under, I guess, under mission, a reference to consensus policy and then a sub-reference to specification one. First of all, I would think that a pointer to a section of a contract does not belong in the bylaws, so I'm not quite sure how you envision this in the final version, but I question whether it's correct to say the ICANN's mission is to coordinate the development and implementation of consensus policies. If you look, for instance, for the GNSO in Annex A, it talks about setting policy, and the specific PDP rules must be used for consensus policy, but for other policies, other rules could be used. So I'm not quite sure why you're restricting this to consensus policy.
Thanks, Alan. Becky, your hand is up, so the floor is yours.
Thank you. So first of all, this language is not intended to be bylaws language, you know, final bylaws language, and I agree that the mission, the final language not, would not refer out to specification one necessarily. Second of all, you and I have had this discussion, and I am a little puzzled as to what kind of policies I can adopt and enforce that are not actually consensus policies. So I continue to be a little puzzled by that. I mean, they are, it is ICANN's obligation to develop policies based on consensus as I understand it.
May I answer?
Please.
Please go ahead,
yeah.
Adam.
Yes, certainly our mission is to develop policies based on consensus, but the expression consensus policy, capitalized, is explicitly used in contracts and in the bylaws regarding things that we generically refer to as within the picket fence in contracts. That is, things that are eligible for being changed immediately upon approval of a policy and implementation of a policy that changes contracts that are already in force. Other policies might, you know, project how we handle something in the future, but they don't necessarily have the effect of changing a contract that's currently in force. And that, I thought, I believe is the definition of consensus policy.
Thank you.
So,
Becky.
I just would like to sort of repeat my request for, I think it would help us have this discussion if we could have some very specific examples of policy that's not consensus policy.
I'll give you one. The new GTLD policy did not have the force of changing existing contracts. For instance, the new GTLD policy said all registries under the new policy will be thick WHOIS registries. That did not have the effect of changing existing contracts. We, in fact, had to go through a completely separate PDP to ensure that all existing registries had thick WHOIS. That's
the simplest
example I can give.
Yes, there's a queue forming, and before we move to the queue, let me try help us navigate this topic. I guess there are two facets to this item. I think one of them is to discuss what ICANN's mission is, i.e., what's the raison d'être for ICANN, and that is to develop policy. The second aspect would be enforceability. So policy that converges into consensus policies would be binding for the contracted parties. Alan has given one example. I can add one to it. The PDP process, for example, in the GNSO has been criticized as being lengthy and cumbersome. And the GNSO is more and more using tools that do not follow the typical PDP life cycle that would enter into consensus policy, but rather give policy advice on other subjects. So if you look, for example, at specification number 13 for brand TLDs, that was deemed policy by the GNSO Council, yet it hasn't chosen to pursue the route of a formal PDP to give policy advice on that. And I'm sure that there are many more examples than that in that area. So I think it's good to have this discussion. The pragmatic way forward maybe would be to just speak to the or use the language referring to policy without specifying the consensus policies in this area, because I think we have covered the consensus policies in other areas of the bylaws. But let's move to the queue, and Caboose is the first one.
Yes, Thomas. I think in order to shorten the discussion at this stage of the first reading, perhaps by introducing a qualifier at the beginning in saying that unless otherwise specified, then go by consensus. Then those specified in the new GTLD or GNSO policy that you have mentioned are those which I think they are specified somewhere. So you could say you start a sentence, whatever you want to start, and then comma, unless otherwise specified in this bylaw or elsewhere or in article, then by consensus. So we need to maintain the consensus. That is a major element. So we could not get rid of that. But let's make exception of that by unless otherwise specified. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Just a point of clarification. Certainly, policy recommendations coming out of the supporting organizations should be carried by consensus, yet not everything that's agreed upon by consensus is a consensus policy, and I think that's a distinction that we need to bear in mind. Sam, please.
Thanks, Thomas. This is Sam Eisner for the record. Thomas, I think that you've stated many of the same things that I was going to say, so I'm not going to repeat them. I support the way that you've been framing this issue and helping to go through the differentiation between policy supported by consensus as opposed to using the term consensus policy that has a defined contractual term, because it not only does that have a defined contractual term, but it also makes it appear that the policies that are implemented through ICANN really may only relate to the GNSO or to the GTLD space, and we have policies based in consensus that arise out of the CC space and the numbering space as well within ICANN. So if we could turn that phrase around, no problem having the issue of consensus being a characteristic of the policy, but they're not consensus policies, just so we don't get confused with that.
Am I still connected, or have we lost audio?
Yes, I think we are still connected. I don't know whether we've lost Thomas.
No, you haven't. Actually, I was talking to a muted microphone. Apologies for that. Ellen, the floor is yours, and I wanted to encourage you to also mention your compromise proposal that you've put forward in the chat.
Thank you. All I said is I have no problem saying the mission is to develop policy by consensus, and perhaps you want to, it needs to be worded slightly more elegantly, but that's not a problem. And to answer Becky's question in the chat, we can set policy outside of our mission all we want. I don't think anyone's going to listen to it, but there are lots of policies that are within our mission that are not going to alter contracts immediately when setting them. So that's the real issue. If we set a policy regarding, IANA, it's not going to alter a contract necessarily, but it may well be a policy.
Thanks, Alan. So we have another suggestion made by Suzanne in the chat. Let me read it out for those who are just on the audio bridge. She wrote, would bottom-up community-based policies be a possible substitute? The point is to constrain ICANN from its own thing, from doing its own thing, right? And that gets some support. Becky has her hand up, and Becky, you might also wish to comment on the alternative proposals that have been made.
I think that something of a combination of the language that Suzanne and Alan have suggested, plus bringing into the specific language of the mission, the policies for which global coordination is necessary to preserve stability, security, interoperability, et cetera. So I will, I can propose a third way. I'm not quite sure how we want to do this in terms of moving forward and getting something out there for people to chew on, but I think that the problem that is being identified is actually probably something that can be solved by specific language.
Thanks, Becky. We have Sebastian and then Greg, and after that I would like to try and take stock of what I've heard the group say so far. Sebastian.
Yes, thank you, Sebastian Bachelet. I guess one part of my trouble is that we are talking about how to constrain ICANN to being only the mission who are already on the bylaw. I just want to take it's written in page 21, for example, and it's also referring here. I just want to take two examples. I know one is more contentious than the other, but how we must have deal with the time zone database. It's outside our mission, and then we don't take it, and then we don't have anyone to manage this database. The second, it's Net Mondial, and the Brazil meeting and the involvement of ICANN. I really think that we need to give to this organization some possibility to breathe, not just to be in a carcan, as we said in French. And my second point, it's about this sentence where we are talking about policy development and we had a lot of different adjective with multi-stakeholder and all that, it's good, but I don't understand why we specify that for policy development, it must be the characteristic of the organization. And I would like to add to multi-stakeholder that we talk about global organization. Thank you.
Thanks, Sebastian. I see that your points are being captured in the chat. I think particularly your point on Net Mondial and the need that you see for ICANN to be flexible and be able to react to developments in the world is a vital one. I think, though, that we are talking about setting policy here, and I think that with the consensus of the community, policy can be set, even in that area potentially, but such consensus would be required. So, there has been a lot of discussion and concern about ICANN mission creeping into other areas, and I think that this tries to help make sure that ICANN does not mission creep. But I think everybody should think about the comments. We've taken note of your points in the chat, so let's hear Greg now.
Thank you, Greg Schatt, and I put my hand up primarily to point out the language I put into the chat that appears just below the 423-2015-1522 line. I see several people have seen it, so I just wanted to point it out to the remainder since I thought it should be, in case some people did not see it. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Alan.
Thank you. I understand the desire of some people to constrain ICANN to its core original mission, and I understand the desire of other people to want to give it some flexibility, but that's not what this paragraph is talking about. It starts off saying its role with respect to domain names. So it is a constrained paragraph, and I don't think we need to worry about the time zone database or Net Mundial in relation to domain names. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I think that's a good point of clarification. I think that the proposal made by Greg could get substantial traction. I would assume that Sebastian is not happy with it, although maybe with the clarification that Alan offered, he would be in line. So, Sebastian, let me check with you whether that's a compromise language that you would be happy with.
First of all, I like that my chair says always reverse than me. That's very good and very appealing to this work. Thank you, Alan, very much. But I would like to know which line we are talking about, because I was talking about page 23. Maybe we are not in the same page. And if we are not, I apologize for that.
Okay, so let's get confirmation on the page. So I think somebody can help me with that. So 21-22, can I ask you all to scroll to pages 21-22? And while it's in the first red paragraph, so I hope that everybody has it now, because I was looking at the document in another window. So it looks like the primary drafter, i.e. Becky, was happy with the suggested change that Greg introduced. Let me check whether there's any opposition to using Greg's proposal. And in the absence of opposition, I would suggest that we reword that phrase and go with that. But I see that Caboose has raised his hand. Caboose, please.
Yes, not objection. Did I understand that the Greg proposal is to a multi-stakeholder bottom-up consensus process?
That is correct.
Yeah, is it easy to implement that? That you go for to have a consensus in the bottom up, in the big community, that one objection may drop everything, or should we make it more simpler? Could you achieve any consensus through the bottom up? Even in this small group like us, it is difficult to have consensus without a very hard discussion. So we should be careful what we put, whether it is implementable or not. Do we need to go that far? Thank you. I'm not objecting,
yes.
Just raising the questions.
And it's a good point, Caboose, reminding us that we need to bear in mind that there are different definitions of consensus in the various groups that we see in ICANN. And the definition with the possibility to object and thereby bring consensus to a halt is the GAC definition that you were alluding to. We have others that would go with rough consensus, still making consensus. For example, the GNSO is using that. But I see that Alan is offering some additional comment on that. Alan?
No, I'm actually not. That was mine was really a more mechanical question. I've been having trouble with page numbers, that they don't match what people are talking about. And I realized the document I looked at, which was pulled off the wiki, is version 1.2, and the one being displayed is 1.1, which is the correct one we're working from.
Actually, I'm looking at this is why I was hesitant to propose a page number, but the version that I see in the main Adobe Room window has the part we're talking about on page 20.
I understand, but the title, you'll notice, is it looks like it's 1.1. The version I pulled off the wiki, which I thought is the most recent, is 1.2. I'd just like some clarity as to which version we're talking about as we go forward.
Okay. Can I ask Becky for a clarification on the version issue and whether that part remains the same?
I think it's staff who pulled the whole paper together, not Becky.
Well, it was. I would say it was a collaborative effort.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
The text of the mission and core values that is in the package, the mission statement beginning on page 19, 6.2. I'm not looking at the wiki, so I'm going to have to take a look at that. But the mission statement itself has not changed since the frozen draft at all. As I said, I did modify the fundamental commitments and core values only to reflect the work that WP1 did on the affirmation of commitments language. So I think that in the stuff in the frozen draft for section 6.3 is very, very modestly out of date, but the language in the frozen draft for section 6.2 is correct.
Yeah, Thomas, for clarity, I wasn't talking about Becky's section. I've had the same problem in the previous two sessions today.
Is
the current one the latest one on the wiki, or is it 1.1 we should be working on and 1.2 was an anomaly we should ignore?
Alan, that's a very good point. And just let's just be perfectly clear. The version that we're using for the first reading during all these initial discussions that we're having is the version that has been frozen. So you're safe to use the 1.1 version as part of our deliberations. Sebastian's hand is up again.
Yes, it's okay. I finally found where it is, and there is the same, maybe same discussion about consensus policy in another paragraph. Here, as we are talking about, I hope that just DNS, but I am not even sure. But if we are just talking about DNS, that's okay. But if we go page, I guess it's page 23. At the bottom of the 23, it's written employ open, transparent, and bottom-up multi-stakeholder policy development processes. And it's where I was commenting on that. Thank you.
So, Sebastian, just to be clear, do you have an objection against this very wording? Because if so, we would need to open that discussion.
I have a proposal to change this on page 23, but we are on page 20, then let's finalize the page 20. If not, I can give you my proposal on page 23. It's up to you. You are the chair.
Yes. Had you confirmed that you have no objection, we could have easily moved on both issues. But since that is not the case, let me first try to take stock on the discussion on page 20. So I have not seen or read any objection against using the proposed wording introduced by Greg. So we're going to use that and put that into the report. I would then ask whether there are any further requests for edits or discussion. And I would assume that, Sebastian, this would be your opportunity to introduce your concerns on page 23.
I just want to repeat that on page 21 at the end of the 6.2. I have trouble with the written way of mission not specifically authorized by these bylaws. I already explained why earlier. And on page 20, 2023, I would like to suggest, first of all, I think it must be written somewhere that ICANN is working, and not just for policy development, it's not just for that, it's for other purposes, must be open, global, bottom-up, multi-equal stakeholder organization. If you want, I can put that in the wiki. Wait a second, I will do that.
Thank you, Sebastian. I think it would be helpful for you to maybe submit your wording in the chat so that everybody has all the information
in one place.
Exactly
what I have done.
Excellent. I'm seeing it now. Thank you so much. Becky, your hand is raised.
Have we moved to page 23?
That is correct.
Okay. There is one thing I definitely want to point out, because this was a subject of a great deal of discussion in Istanbul. At the very top of the page, on page 23, the fundamental commitments, we've added language from the Articles of Incorporation that references international law, and it says ICANN must operate for the benefit of the internet community as a whole, carrying out its activities in conformity with relevant principles of international law and applicable law and applicable and international conventions, and through open and transparent processes, et cetera. That language is directly taken from the Articles of Incorporation, but in order to make it durable or fundamental and therefore difficult to change, and in response to some of the discussion we had in Istanbul, we moved it into the fundamental commitments language, and so it would become a fundamental bylaw.
Thank you for that. Becky, any further interventions? Any support for the suggested language introduced by Sebastian? Can we have some feedback on that? You know, just in terms of how we operate, I think we, in order to introduce new topics to the text that we've suggested, I think we would need some traction for suggested amendments. So I would suggest that we keep the language as it is for the time being, and allow for the group to further digest. The language is in the notes for this call, and I'm more than happy to reopen the discussion should more members of this group suggest that we should amend the language. So with that, I would like to give you another opportunity to comment on or suggest further amendments to this part of the report. So that does not...
Sorry, Thomas, Jordan here.
Jordan.
I'm really confused now about which part of the report we're looking at. Are we talking about the table still with the mission on page 2021, or are we talking about the table that's labeled 6.3 fundamentals, which is actually the fundamental commitments? Because if we're working through that table, the one that starts on page 21, the fundamental commitments and core values, then we need to go to the other document that Becky had circulated. So can you please clarify what we're working on?
Yes, so far we've discussed language on page 20, and page 23. But it's both in the same document. Does that answer the question?
No, it doesn't, because I'm trying to work out what we're meant to be focused on now. Are we still meant to be focused on the mission text, or have we moved on? Because if we're looking at the table that starts Fundamental Bylaws on page 21, there is a different document that we should be looking at, which combines the Working Party 1 and Working Party 2 suggestions. It's the one that was on screen before this was put up, and it's the one that Becky emailed around on the list a few hours ago. So if we're going to be discussing the fundamental commitments and core values, I think we have to move to that document, not use this one.
But you're speaking about the section that was missing, correct?
I'm not speaking about the section that was missing. I'm talking about exactly on page 21 in the bottom half, a new table starts. It's got a heading called Fundamental Bylaws. And the first line in red is Fundamental Commitments and Core Values. Becky circulated a paper a few hours ago that has an updated version of that in the sense that it includes in one place both the suggestions that her working party made, which is on page 21, 22, 23, and includes the suggestions that Working Party 1 had made to these core values. So if we're going to be working through that, we need what has now appeared on the screen. We need this table. That's why we have to separate the discussion too. Sorry. I hope that
And you're correct, and thank you so much for pointing that out. Nonetheless, I think it was good for us to have a discussion on what was the frozen version of the document. Since we've finished the discussion on that paper, obviously, let's now focus on the changes to the section, the purple version, as we called it. I apologize for this being more difficult to follow than necessary. But Becky, maybe you can facilitate further discussions by again highlighting the changes that have been made, so that people can comment if need be.
Okay. Again, these have been circulated and quite stable. On the second page of the document that's up on the screen now, in the fundamental commitments item one, on the left we have the language about preserving and enhancing operational stability, which is the current language. WP2 modified the language to include resilience and openness of the DNS and the Internet. And in purple below that, WP1 suggested adding the following additional language, saying that ICANN must maintain the capacity and ability to coordinate the Internet DNS at the overall level and to work for the maintenance of a single interoperable Internet. That is language that appears in the affirmation of commitments. I think it is implicit in the fundamental commitment one, but I have no problem adding it as it is completely consistent with what has been what we've been talking about. Fundamental commitment number three also includes some purple language, which again imports language from the affirmation of commitment related to the language that specifically says ICANN is obligated to seek input from the public for whose benefit ICANN shall in all events act, and references the private sector leadership. Again, that is in the affirmation of commitment. Then going down to the next page, In core values number one, work party one suggested referencing affirmation of commitment 3B that says that making sure that decisions are made in the global public interest and are accountable, transparent, and respect the bottom-up multi-stakeholder nature of ICANN. Again, that's consistent with what the work of WP2 was. Core value number three in the middle there has the purple graph referencing enhancing consumer trust and choice, again, directly from the affirmation of commitment. And then, and that's it. So those are the modest changes. They are all directly intended to reflect the affirmation of commitments. And so in order to make sure that we're all on the same page, because we were working, you know, we were working simultaneously, and in some cases it was difficult to coordinate the work that was going on before the frozen draft. What I've put together here is just an attempt to make sure that all of the recommendations of Work Party 1 are in this Fundamental Commitments and Core Values section.
Thanks, Becky. I'm just conscious of time. In the planning that we have done prior to this meeting, we've allocated another 2 minutes to the subject, but I don't want to interrupt the discussion now, but I'm nonetheless going to close the queue after James. I would like to ask you to keep your interventions as briefly as brief as possible. Also, I think we don't have to do wordsmithing as a group exercise now. So we're rather trying to get confirmation on the general ideas, whether you agree with what's in there, and then maybe we can take minute changes to the language offline. Izumi is next.
Thanks. So regarding this text that we're looking at, I support what's being incorporated. It's very much in line with the values that is commonly shared and also in line with the work of the Work Party 1. Actually, I wanted to comment about the previous section, not this fundamental bylaw section. It seemed that it got skipped before I had a chance to comment. And I just want to raise that there was a part that was left to insert are related to the IP address and the ASN and the number of resources. And I don't know if the intention was to leave it as it is and not really write anything concrete, or it was just left that way because people didn't have an idea to what to write. And if that's the latter case, then we actually sent a suggestion to on the mailing list. So I just want to share that. Thanks.
Thank you, Izumi. Becky, I think I will give you the opportunity to respond after we've listened to the others that have queued. Cavus.
Thomas, you remember yesterday we discussed this affirmation of commitment, and that is the term used between the U.S. government or NTIA and ICANN. And after all this transition, whether or not we have this term, apart from that, whether in the bylaw we have the term ICANN commits. Yesterday, Steve Del Bianco mentioned that, yes, we will change that instead of saying ICANN commit, saying that ICANN shall do. So we have to raise the flag that at a later stage, this term needs to be replaced by an appropriate term. So I don't understand fundamental commitment. Is it a fundamental bylaw or not? But why is it fundamental commitment? Do we have unfundamental commitment as well in this text? So we have to clarify the matter at a later stage. I don't want to waste the time at this stage, but we have to make note of that this term needs to be revisited to be put in an appropriate term which corresponds to the new bylaw. So we don't have a fundamental commitment. We have a fundamental bylaw, but not fundamental commitment, because we don't have non-fundamental commitment. Thank you.
Thank you, Cabos. Greg.
Thanks, Greg Chatton. I'm not sure if this is the right point in the overall agenda for our high-intensity working session. And if it isn't, I'll reserve further comment on the subject to the right place, and I would appreciate knowing what the right place is, to discuss the deletion of Section 8B from the Affirmation of Commitments. It's the sole ICANN commitment from the Affirmation of Commitments that has not made its way into this version of the document. And somehow we've managed to avoid discussing it somehow, maybe inadvertently. But is this the right time, or is there another time allotted for that in our agenda?
We will have plans for another place in the agenda to discuss this, but let's do this. Let's briefly give Becky the opportunity to respond to the proposal. It is my view that Izumi's proposal got some traction, and afterwards I would like to hand it over to Steve Del Bianco to speak to the 8B question. But Becky first.
Izumi's proposed language, I'll look at it carefully and work it in, and that's great. And I appreciate that, Izumi and Athena. I think you probably worked on it together. Caboose's point is well taken. The words, I'm not deeply wedded to the words fundamental commitments, and I'll try to think of something else to describe them. And I think Steve will talk to the other issue.
Thank you very much, Becky. Steve.
Thank you. Greg, we discussed this briefly last week. Page 47 of the frozen document was where Affirmation of Commitments, paragraph 8, was mapped to where it would go in the core values or elsewhere in the bylaws. And I'm speaking of page 47 in the frozen document. 8A and 8C were brought over as a new core value, and Becky reflected that in the purple text. But in our last call, we discussed that 8B, which is that ICANN would remain a not-for-profit corporation headquartered in the U.S. with offices around the world to meet the needs of a global community. We did a very careful read of the existing bylaws and Article 18, Section 1, reads in a way that, Greg, I believe that you would acknowledge we can check this box, that we pretty much have this covered in the bylaws. I'll read it to you. It says, the principal office for the transaction of the business of ICANN shall be in the county of Los Angeles, state of California, U.S. of A. That is a normative statement. It says shall be, so it's not just a descriptive statement like the articles have for where ICANN happens to be located today. So given that Article 18 of the bylaws says shall, and we're empowering ourselves to be able to block a bylaws change that the community doesn't support, it struck a number of us that 8B of the affirmation is already reflected in ICANN's existing bylaws. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. I think it's a good time now for us to move on to the next agenda item.
Could I just briefly respond to Steve?
If you can, keep it brief, please.
Yeah, I would say that if, in fact, this 8B from the Affirmation of Commitments is redundant, we should state that that is why this is not being taken forward into this section. And I guess the issue then is that going to be fundamental or not? If we're taking all of the rest of the Affirmation of Commitment, and if we're making those into fundamental bylaws but not making the other one into a fundamental bylaw, why are we making that distinction? And the reason I say this is that in the language of the document preceding this section, it pretty much gives the impression that we're taking all of the ICANN commitments that are in the AOC and transporting them into the bylaws. I think we need to be express about this, and if we feel it's unnecessary because it's redundant, we should say so. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. And Ellen, sorry to disappoint you, but I had closed the queue after Greg, and I would really suggest that for the updated version of this report, maybe those who have suggestions on the concrete language do get in touch with Becky or WP1 to ensure that we get all the input in there. But I think that's not for the plenary to discuss now. The only remaining point before I hand over to Mathieu to chair the next session would be the point made by Ingrid in the chat. Ingrid, maybe if you could, maybe you can give us a 1, 2, or 3 sentence long explanation of what you're referring to, because I trust that not all of us do know what was in your statement of the 20th. So, Ingrid, if you could maybe briefly refresh everybody's memory, that would be awesome.
Hi, yes, this is Ingrid Mittermeier, one of the legal counsel. Yeah, we had submitted responses in a memo dated April 20th. A lot of what we commented on had to do with thinking carefully about what parts of these mission statements and core commitments belongs in the Articles of Incorporation versus the bylaws. That's in U.S. Legal entities, an important distinction between these two sets of governing documents. That can still be worked out. I think the main pieces to remember is, one, that these will create legal restrictions, and so any of the wording needs to be flexible enough to really encompass everything that the organization does want to do going forward, and I know people are very mindful on it. There was a little bit of a narrower comment that if there's a reference in the mission statement or in the core commitments to international law, that just needs to be a careful reference. So it's those kinds of legal comments. We just want to make sure at the right point those will be taken into consideration as further drafting occurs.
Thank you very much, Ingrid. That's a good reminder. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Mathieu to chair the next part of the agenda.
Thank you very much, Thomas. The next part of the agenda is about this item where we had a slight coordination issue between Work Party 1 and Work Party 2, and that is why the document that we will be discussing is this memo that was circulated yesterday about the fundamental bylaws. And our task is greatly helped by the fact that we had a good discussion in Istanbul on the fundamental bylaws, and the conclusions were confirmed in our meeting in March 31st, where we said that there would be provision in the bylaws where any change would require affirmative approval with specific procedure requirements from community, and the scope of these bylaws would include the commission, the provisions creating special bylaws, the independent review panel, and the powers to change bylaws and fill the board. So we had basically already agreed on the principle, agreed on the scope. We have legal confirmation that it's feasible, subject to where we put them. So most of our discussion tonight is actually about the additional elements that were provided in the memo about the thresholds to propose and approve, propose a modification of the fundamental bylaws, the threshold to approve them, maybe the process, and also take into account one of the comments that was made by Jan-Art Scholze, one of our advisors, about the risk if we set thresholds too high, that we actually fossilize and create some an ability for ICANN to change when its environment changes after that. And he took a couple of examples, including the International Monetary Fund, where too high thresholds were actually impairing evolution that was, according to some, needed. So that's, I think, the core of our discussions that we need to have now. Becky, would you have anything else to add? Or Jordan, because you wrote this document together?
Not I.
Jordan?
Just briefly to respond to a point that was made in one of our previous calls about whether there would be a section of the bylaws called fundamental bylaws, which listed all the fundamental bylaws. This memo doesn't propose taking this step. This memo says that there will be a provision in the bylaws that kind of lists which ones are fundamental. And the reason for that is there may be parts of, for example, the GNSO PDP, there may be parts of the appointment of the board, so the removal process, that make more sense to leave in the place that they belong in the context of the bylaws than to drag them out and stick them into a special fundamental bylaws section. So it's just saying that if we go with the proposal that's written down, there will be a section somewhere in the bylaws that says these are the fundamental bylaws and lists them so you can easily find them, but there wouldn't be just one longer section in the bylaws that included all of the bits that were fundamental in one place. It would be easier to find fundamental bylaws if we put them all in one place, but it would make the bylaws altogether harder to understand, less transparent, harder for the community to use, and therefore it would probably harm accountability purposes if we were to just lump all the fundamental bits in together.
Thanks, Jordan. I noticed a question by Sam in the chat, and having no other hand in the queue, is why is the process only defined for fundamental bylaw changes that are identified by the board staff? And what if a proposal was recommended through a community process? Did you consider that question? Is that an intention that it moves through the board only?
We did encounter that. If you look on the second page of this memo, in section 6.3.3, subparagraph 4 under there, it says that the CCWG welcomes feedback on whether there's a need as part of Workstream 1 to provide for any other means or other parts of the ICANN system fail to propose new fundamental bylaws or changes to existing ones. As the lead drafter for this memo, my familiarity with the range of ways that changes to the bylaws could arise. I don't know whether there are a wide range of ways that bylaws changes might already come into existence, but it's that we were trying to capture that at the moment, in the end, I think wherever these things emerge from, they do end up at the board making a decision. So that was the place to insist additional process.
Thank you, Jordan. Sam, you raised your hand. Sam, are you talking to a muted microphone? Sam, we can't hear you. Oh, you're coming in, Sam.
Hello? Can you hear
yes.
me now?
Oh, I can. Yes.
All right. Sorry, there was a mute that I was not in control of on there. So am I to understand that this process is only invoked after the board approves a bylaws change and then it's sent somewhere? Do we have an opportunity to reflect where something might be out for public comment? And, you know, there are places where changes to the bylaws occur because they do come out of a community process. For example, the modifications to the policy development process that happened after the GNSO restructuring in 2008-2009, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say that those bylaws provisions came out of the board. Similarly, for the addition of the at-large director, those were both things that came out of community processes. So there's a board point where the board currently says, yes, you can put that out for public comment. And so if the board putting something out for public comment is the trigger, I get that, but I think the bylaws come out of multiple ways currently through the organization, and they could impact fundamental issues.
Thank you very much, Sam. Jordan, a direct response, maybe.
Look, there's no intention to change anything involved with the current process or to limit away from what can happen now. That's why paragraph 3A in the 6.3.3 very deliberately uses through the usual process. It could say through the usual processes. So the point here is that if something was going to be an addition as a fundamental bylaw or a change to a fundamental bylaw, it would be flagged all through that process. And when it got to the point of Bohr's proposal for public comment, it would be identified as such. The board would need to cast a higher than usual majority. The community would have to co-approve it. But there is no intention to limit the way these things happen. It just seems obvious that at the moment, wherever they arise in the community, they do go through the board in the end, which does the public consultation. So what we're trying to do here is to interfere as little as possible with current processes. It may be easier to get that or to avoid the confusion by removing some of that language in subparagraph 3. So you can say to establish a new fundamental bylaw or to change or remove an existing one, the following steps would be followed, and just get rid of this, where the board, blah, blah, blah. And then you could add, you could leave subparagraph 4 there. This is a high-level concept. We don't need to get stuck in the detail about where bylaw changes come from and so on, I don't think.
Thanks, Jordan. I think we could, however, take the action you're suggesting to clarify this item, because Sam's comment shows that we would need to be very clear that we are not changing the existing processes and that it will remain bottom-up processes that come up with the proposals to add or change the or remove the fundamental bylaws. I think there's a lot of value in this, but that's editorial, and we can take that after the meeting. Next in the line is Cavus. Please, Cavus.
Yes, Matthew. The document jointly produced, does it goes into the public document, or just it is for discussions and some relevant part of that goes into the public document, starting by the bylaw? I think the bylaw comprises two sections or two parts, fundamental bylaw and non-fundamental, whatever you want to give that, and then try to see what is fundamental and so on. So my question is that, how the idea reflected in this document will be included in the document for public comments? Or you want to just cut and paste whatever is here and put it in the public document? That is simple questions.
Everything that would start after 6.3 fundamental bylaws will be pasted into the document for public comment. Correct, Jordan?
Yes, that's the idea. So this language here would sit in under section 6.3, where at the moment it just says fundamental bylaws, straight into that table, because as we know, that table isn't actually the fundamental bylaws. It's the fundamental commitments and core values. So we will need to just fix the headings, and we do need a section that talks about this. The idea was this language could just be copied and pasted into the comment report.
Thank you, Jordan. And I'm seeing a question by Pedro on what is the reason behind making 18.1 fundamental. So 18.1, I'm afraid I don't get exactly what that refers to right away. Certainly, Jordan and Becky know that. Or maybe, Pedro, you want to explain? You raise your hand. Pedro, we can't hear you so far. Pedro, you're still muted. A comment on the chat from David mentions that you were probably referring to 8.1 from the AOC, and that would be the headquarter location. So if that is correct, there was so that's referring to the previous discussion on the headquarters. So I would rather we'll certainly move this discussion to a discussion we were planning to have when we review the various stress tests. Stress test issued recommendations, so there will be room for further discussion of that. But that's the point is well noted, and I think Steve took this item to heart to check the point about whether this particular provision would benefit from the fundamental bylaw protection or not. But that is certainly a question we have. Steve, do you want to answer to that? And I suppose that Sam's hand is an old hand, but this is just supposition. Steve.
Thank you, Matthew. To clarify, 18.1 doesn't refer to affirmation 8.1. 18.1 is the current bylaws provision that I quoted earlier. And to make it easier for people, I pasted it into the chat of 18.1. The principal office for the transaction of business shall be in the County of Los Angeles. So, earlier in the chat, we had a few folks ask what would be the rationale that 18.1 be listed among the items that are considered fundamental and thereby require positive approval. And that is a discussion that Greg initiated. A few folks in the chat agreed, and others are asking to debate that move. So I'm just clarifying for you, Matthew, that 18.1 is existing bylaws, and it's seen as pretty consistent with affirmation of commitments, section 8B, which is why we don't necessarily have to add 8B to the bylaws. But we still have an open question of whether 18.1 in the current bylaws needs to become fundamental.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. That's very clear. So that's an open question we have to come back to tomorrow, and that's well noted. And we need to come back with some form of rationale, whether we want to put it in the fundamental bylaws or whether we don't want to, but at least there needs to be some explanation given the importance of the topic. So with this, I would like to check whether there's any objection to incorporating the 6.3 language from the memo into your public comment report. I'm seeing none, but I need to check that I'm not losing anyone. Okay, so this we will then do that, and you will receive an updated version. And I'd like to really stress the excellent work that Becky and Jordan have done together to catch up with this item. And I mean, they did an outstanding work overall, but on this item as well. Izumi, you have a last question, maybe.
Yes, I wasn't aware that we're covering the whole section of R6.3, and so sorry about being late about raising hands. So I actually made a comment on the mailing list as well. So there are parts that about this policy development that seems to be assumed to be like covering all related policies. It doesn't really specify that it's mainly related to the names, but the things work a little bit different for the numbers and the names. So I do want to raise this, and I think we already have good language on the document that applies for the names policy. So I wouldn't want to suggest changing that, but add a memo somewhere that if this description is considered to be applicable to the numbers resources policies, then further consideration should be made. And then maybe leave it up to the numbers community to come up with the necessary suggestions during the public comments. So that's my suggestion.
Thank you very much, Izumi. Very constructive suggestion. I think you were referring to 6.3 from the frozen document, which was the previous discussion on core values and commitments and mission. But the comment is valid anyway, so we'll ensure we capture that in the edits we are doing into this section. I did notice your contribution detailed and constructive on the mailing list, so that will be certainly easy to integrate. With that, I think we have made good progress on the fundamental ILOs, and we will now turn to, I think it's Leon. Is it Leon?
Are yes,
you
it's me.
Going to chair the IRP part? Maybe
I will try. I will try at least. Well, as you know, in our draft report, I believe on page 26, is if we could just bring that up into our screens. I believe it's page 26, as I said. We have the independent review panel. And this, as I understand it, might be, if not the most important goal to achieve, certainly it is one of the most important. We do have a review process right now in place with regards to some of the operations that are undertaken in ICANN. But we, of course, feel that we need to improve this process, because right now what we have is a review process that only takes into account process, but it doesn't go into substance. So while gathering comments from the community, many commenters raised the question or the concern that if we were to design an independent review panel as a new review process or as a new review mechanism, then this independent review panel would need to also look into substantive issues rather than just analyzing whether ICANN have kept its actions according to the process or procedural matters. So we have, of course, many things to consider here. I believe that the most relevant issues at this point are as they are, of course, open questions in our document. Are the outcomes, whether these outcomes would be binding or could be binding, the finality of these outcomes, whether they can be appealed or not, the selection process of these standing panel, and, of course, the size of the panel and the diversity and independence of the panel. So we received feedback from council as to whether this process may be or may not be binding. And I would like to have the lawyers speak a little bit about binding viability of this review panel in a moment. I would like now to turn to Becky. So I don't know, Becky, if you want to add anything to this very brief introduction that I have made about the IRP.
No, I think you've done a very good job of summarizing it. I hope that we have clearly signaled the sort of the direction in which we're headed, and the questions that remain to be filled out. And in particular, in the document, there are questions that we think would benefit from community consultation. Clearly, questions about outcomes, questions about the finality of the process, the selection process for panelists, the size of the panel itself, and diversity and independence issues are quite important. I don't know if folks on the call have particular issues that they want to raise now, or whether people are content with the direction and then the level of questions that we will seek input from the community on.
Thank you very much, Becky. So I see some comments on the chat. One from Jorge Cancio, who's supporting the idea that having, of course, binding outcomes is quite important for our goals. So I'd like to turn to Ed McNicholas from Sidley to give us a brief walkthrough the last memo they sent us with regards to the feasibility or the viability on having the IRP process being a binding process. And I would also remind you that we also received another memo from Council just very recently, and it was circulated. And on page 5 of that document, we have a summary chart, which I find most useful for those of us who are non-U.S. lawyers. And, of course, those who are not lawyers, either from the U.S. or from outside, we have this chart that will be able to guide us through different issues throughout our session. So I'd like to turn now to Ed McNicholas. Ed, could you please take the floor?
Yes, this is Ed from Sidley. Let me just speak to the, as clearly as we can, to the enforceability of the IRP process. Particularly for the broader audience, we sent around, just as this meeting was starting, a very brief one-page answer to the question of the issue, could the IRP process be enforceable? And in that, we've tried to make sure that the overall answer is clearly yes. The IRP process can be enforceable. It's limited by the scope of the agreement of the parties, and there's a little bit of back to unpack there, and there are a couple exceptions. But the overall message and the overall takeaway should be that it is it can be enforceable for the vast number of areas. But let me unpack what I've meant by the idea that it's limited by the scope of the agreement of the parties. There's a very strong policy under the Federal Arbitration Act of encouraging parties to resolve disputes in a binding way, and so the parties have great flexibility in designing the sort of process they want in terms of defining how many arbitrators, the qualifications of those arbitrators, the rules of decision of those arbitrators. So the agreement of the parties is vital to this. The agreement in our context would be probably in two places. One, it would be in the ICANN bylaws so that it would be binding on anyone subject to the ICANN bylaws. But then you'd have to think, well, how is this binding upon the members or designators? In the agreement to which they would become members or designators, we could insert the arbitration clause into that. So both the members and designators and ICANN would be bound by it. There was an inquiry about, well, does this exclude third parties? No, it does not exclude third parties. Any third party that wanted to use the agreement, wanted to use the IRP process, could do so with ICANN's agreement and that third party's agreement. And so if we wrote the bylaws that this process is available to third parties as long as they agree to be bound by the process themselves, then a binding arbitration could be available to those third parties. The arbitration is enforceable in a sense that the award of the IRP, one, it would probably be – people would probably comply with it. ICANN would probably comply with it just because it was a decision of the IRP. But let's walk out a scenario in which, for some reason, there was a – one of the parties to the agreement did not want to comply with the IRP decision. What would be done with that? Well, in that case, the prevailing party could take that decision to a court and get a court order there basically compelling compliance with it. There is a review by the court to make sure that the award reflected due process, to make sure the award was within the scope of the agreement of the parties. But as long as those basic procedural fairness criteria are met, the award would be enforceable pursuant to a federal court order. So it is strongly enforceable in that sense. There is also these awards can be taken to the courts of many other countries. I can't get into every other country out there, but there is broad international acceptance of these sorts of awards. In fact, arbitration is used frequently in the international commercial context for this very reason. But let me talk about two exceptions that, and I want to make sure that we view these as the exception, not the rule, and not get unduly delayed by them. The one are member are powers reserved to the members. I recognize it's an open question about whether there will be members or designators, and that's a, but if there are members under California law, powers can be reserved to them. And this may be a very effective way if you want the, community wants to have certain powers reserved to the members, the maybe a power to initiate a budget, to veto a budget, to review a budget, to approve a budget, whatever, however that power wants to be phrased, those powers can be reserved to the members in the document, in the organic document, the documents that set up the membership structure. And so if the members are to decide an issue and not the board, then that process, that decision would not be reviewable by the IRP because that would be within the sphere of the membership and not the board. It would give a, it's a very strong accountability measure up front. It does pull it out of the back-end accountability of the IRP, but it's a very strong accountability measure up front when people talk about a community veto in the budget or a strategic plan or whatever the scope of that is decided. Again, there's a lot of flexibility in the law provided for that. There is also a limitation in the law that is I can't say it's crystal clear, but there is definitely a limit there that there are matters that are so material to the conduct of being a board that to subject them to IRP review would undermine the statutory obligations on the fiduciary role of the IRP. For instance, if you had everything the board could possibly decide subject to IRP review, then if you think about it, the IRP becomes the board. And if there are concerns about accountability of the board, you would only have transferred those same concerns about accountability to the accountability of the IRP. And we'd have a lot fewer accountability mechanisms over the IRP than the board. And so if you think about it as the IRP as a quasi-judicial body, you need to have courts have limited jurisdiction so that they do not wind up becoming the executive and not stepping out of the judicial role. And so there is this fiduciary limitation on central functions that could not be submitted to binding arbitration. The exact line in the law there is not clear. The discussion is essentially that Some things are so core to being a fiduciary that to put those in the hands of a third party would make you not the fiduciary anymore. But again, that's an exception. That's a very small exception in the middle of the core central duties of the board. There are the powers reserved to the members, the powers kind of inherent in being a board. But beyond those, the basic answer is that the IRP can function very effectively in this quasi-judicial manner. And even outside of that area, you have a the IRP would have ability to issue advisory rulings. So even if there was some question about was this a core function or not, it could be put to the IRP and they could issue an advisory ruling. And even if it's technically only advisory, it might be helpful in resolving the dispute nonetheless. So that is kind of an overview of where the IRP process would be.
Thank you very much for that, Ed. There are some questions already been raised in the chat. I have two specific questions from Farsan Abadi. The first one being, where will be the jurisdiction to challenge to some arbitration award, to which court, and whether this resolution could be substantially challenged or not. So could you please comment a little bit on that, Ed?
If there's an arbitration between two parties that have agreed to the arbitration, let's say if between a member and the ICANN board, and they put there was a dispute and they put it to the IRP, the challenge to that in court would be a very limited one. The grounds of challenging an arbitral award under the Federal Arbitration Act are essentially assume that the process was that the agreement was, in fact, to be arbitrated under the agreement of the party, on the parties, and that the procedural fairness was respected by the IRP. So if the agreement was to have three arbitrators and there was only one, that could be a way to challenge it on that kind of procedural ground. But the federal courts would not look back since of the dispute if it was properly within the jurisdiction of the IRP and they issued their decision, there would effectively be no appeal from that. It is meant as a binding decision.
Good. That's very useful to know. Thank you very much. Another question was raised by Becky, asking if you could please clarify if it's possible to make the existing scope of the RFP materially harmed, etc., binding, even if the parties are not members.
The rule of the rule of decision is a flexible one, and so you could have whatever standard be. You could have violation of the bylaws. You could have whether someone is harmed. Whatever rule of decision the group wanted could be imported. Usually, it's compliance with the bylaws and articles. But you could have that the rule of decision be. What the group wanted in terms of the for parties that are not members, for truly third parties, they could agree to the process when they go into it, much like the familiar domain name process where people agree to be bound by it when they sign up for a domain name. Here, if you wanted to bring a dispute to the IRP in that process, you would be bound by it. I don't know if that's responsive to Becky's question or not.
Thanks. Would that answer your question, Becky?
I guess the question is, would ICANN have to agree in each case to make it binding, or could they agree up front that if somebody is material harmed by a violation of the bylaws, that they could bring an IRP and the decision would be binding? So could they agree in advance that it would be binding, or would they have to agree in each case?
They could agree on a blanket way in the bylaws. saying that they would be expressing an openness to agree to agreeing to arbitration with anyone who has been who claims to have been materially harmed by their decision. And so it would be essentially an open offer of to arbitrate anyone who says that they are harmed by this. And so, yes, you could open that up, and then the party would have their choice of – the third party would have the choice of taking the board up on its offer to arbitrate, or if they were a third party not in any way bound to arbitrate, they could look for their judicial remedies. But once they went down the IRP route, then they would be down the arbitration route.
Thank you very much for this. Ed, there's another question from David McCauley with regards to the exceptions or the limitations on whether this IRP would be binding or not. And it refers to who would define or who would decide which issues involve those matters that are so material to the board that it would undermine its statutory obligations and fiduciary roles. Could you elaborate on this? Could you give us a little bit more clarity on this?
Ultimately, that would be decided by the courts. There are really only a handful of cases on this because most boards only would participate in arbitration over a smaller set of issues. But the ICANN board, I mean, clearly there's an emphasis in the community on having more arbitration, and so this is a very broad scope of arbitration we're talking about. The idea is that there are some things that are so central to the board. For instance, the writing of its bylaws may well be a core board function, that an arbitration could not compel the board to add a new bylaw. Now, you could get IRP review or arbitral review of compliance with a bylaw, and that would be, but it's not rewriting the board's bylaws for itself. Exactly how far that goes out, there's a notion in the law of the business judgment rule that some things are within the management discretion of the board. I don't think it probably goes that far. It might. But there is a bit of gray there in the law, and it is there because it's not been litigated that frequently. One thing I did want to point out about the process is the IRP process does allow the board to recognize the standing of whomever they want to participate in this process, and so. Even though a legal entity can't go into something that is not an association, a formal unincorporated association, may not be able to go into court and sue ICANN, they could participate in the IRP process as long as that process was to recognize their standing. And so they could entities that might not be able to go into court could still participate in the IRP process. So it can be an extremely broad binding process, if that is what it's desired. There's a great amount of flexibility in the law there.
Thank you very much for this, Ed. I see Caboose hand is up and Holly hand is up, but before going to them, I just want to clarify some comments that I see on the chat. The first one being Caboose, and then I think it's in line with what Finn Pedersen has expressed in the chat. We are discussing an internal solution for the independent review panel. This would be a standing panel formed by members of the community, as far as I understand, or as far as it is explained in the document. And we are not looking into an external solution at this point. I mean, it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that we can't look at it, but so far how it's stated in the draft document, it refers to an internal but independent panel, And this, of course, needed to be clarified. So now I'll go to Cavus. Cavus, do you have your hand raised? Could you please take the floor?
Yes, Leon. You replied to one of my questions, that you are not dealing with the external entity. Thank you very much. The second small issue is what Matthew said at the beginning. After 1.5 hours, you have some some minutes of pause. So don't forget that. And the second point I want to raise is that all these discussions about enforceability and viability of the IRRP, is it equally applicable to the designator model, or are you just talking about member model? Because the legal counsel referred several times to members, whether these members was in the context of the member model or members in the general term. Just a clarification whether the enforceability applies to both models, members and designators, or they are different. Thank you.
So, Leon, it's Holly. May I answer that? That's what I had my hand up for, because I was thinking that maybe we needed to clarify that.
Absolutely, Holly. Please do.
So, there are parallel points here. The IRP exception that my colleague Ed discussed around fiduciary matters that must be reserved to the board is the very sort of same legal underpinning for the difference between members and directors to a degree, and designators. Members, you are able to reserve some things that you might typically give to a board. Not everything, because then the members would be the directors. But you are really much more limited in the ability to give things to designators that could read on the fiduciary duties of the directors. And so there's a parallelism between this point on the limits of the IRP and the limits of what you can give to designators and third parties. So the IRP point means that members and designators are somewhat different in the IRP world. Now, of course, as Ed said at the outset, what it really means is if you've reserved something to the members, that item that's been reserved to the members is also not within the IRP overview, because you've determined that the members are the ultimate decision maker. So if there was a dispute over powers regarding what the members had done, it's not clear that the IRP would be able to address that particular kind of dispute. And Ed, if you could just confirm that I've gotten that right.
Yes, yes, that would be, that's exactly right. And on one level, the IRP process, it's clear that the IRP process can exist and exist robustly in both models, but there is that difference.
Well, thank you very much for your explanations. As you can see in the chat, they are highly appreciated, and we're most thankful for this job you're performing. And I see David McCullough's hand is up, so David, can you please take the floor?
Thank you, Liam. It's David McCullough. Ed, I have one more question on IRP. There's been some mention of enforcement in courts, enforcement of an IRP order. I just want to clarify, isn't it true that if there was an issue that arose in another place where ICANN was subject to jurisdiction, that someone could seek relief in a foreign, in a court in Belgium or Singapore or wherever it might be? It's not limited to U.S. courts to enforce IRP decisions. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, if as long as we structured the IRP process, and I think we would intend to structure it this way, so that it was consistent with some of the international agreements on enforcement of arbitration, you could indeed take it to many other jurisdictions and enforce it. Rules of the other jurisdiction may come into play, and they may not have as strong a presumption in favor of arbitration as the Federal Arbitration Act, but most courts in many countries it's a very common thing to have a presumption in favor of enforcement of international arbitration. But I don't want to say that it's everywhere all the time, because that would be a huge legal survey.
Thank you for this. I saw Kabu's hand was up, but it suddenly just disappeared. Kabu, do you want to add something?
I know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So with this, I think it's been a very useful introduction to the discussion on how the outcomes can, in fact, be binding under certain circumstances, and of course, with some limits to that. The finality, it's been said that it can either be a final solution or, depending on many variables, of course, it could also be subject to appeals. And we are beginning to jump into selection process, which will, of course, lead us to size of panel and diversity and independence. So at this point, I see someone asking for a break time. So I think it would be in order to have a five-minute break at this point. So if we all agree on this, we can break for 5 minutes, and then we could be able to reconvene so we can jump right into the discussion on how we would like to select the members of this standing panel, which size it would have, and, of course, how we would address diversity and independence. So if we all agree to this, we can have a five-minute break. Do we agree? Okay, I hear no objection, so I think that is an overwhelming yes for a break. So let's break for 5 minutes, and we'll reconvene. And let's go and stretch our legs. Thanks. Okay, so it's time for us to reconvene. If you agree, we can jump back into our discussions. And I'd like to begin by answering some need for clarification requested by Caboose on whether if there's any relation between the term IRP and arbitration. My personal view is that an independent review panel is in fact an arbitration, but of course I would like to pose these questions to the lawyers, so we don't assume and rather have of course informed advice on this. So anyone from the legal team could be able to guide us as whether IRP is an equivalent of an arbitration procedure?
This is Ed McNicholas. If I could go to that. Yes, the IRP can be structured in such a way. In theory, one could structure an internal review process so that it was not an arbitration. But the way it seems to be contemplated, the IRP would be structured as what would be recognized as an arbitral body if it's an independent decision maker. And so even though it's an internal in some sense, it would be still considered an arbitral body, recognizing that there's some tension between the words internal and independent. But if it's an independent body as the way it's contemplated, then its decisions should be enforceable as long as we stick within the bounds of the Federal Arbitration Act, which are, as I said, very flexible.
Thank you very much for this. So, well, now I'd like to begin jumping into conclusions for our document. In page 27, we have the possible outcomes and two open issues for a question. I believe that the second issue has been already addressed, and this issue refers to the extent that the board cannot be bound by an IRP decision. Is the ability to recall some or all members of the board a sufficient mechanism to ensure compliance with panel decisions? Since we know that the IRP can in fact be binding, then I think this question has been already addressed, and we wouldn't need to recall some or all members of the board to have the board take the IRP decision as binding. Of course, if they would they wouldn't comply, I believe that the mechanism of spelling the void would in fact be something that could be explored. But the first question, it says that some members of the working group feel that the board or the committee would need to be permitted under certain circumstances to reject an IRP decision, like, for example, with unanimous support of the board and a designated community body. But, of course, there are others that think that this would defeat the purpose of having an IRP all the way. So I'd like to call for agreement. My view, and this is of course my personal view, is that the IRP, since we've been told that it's an arbitration procedure, and when we abide ourselves to arbitration procedures, we are of course willing to take any outcome as mandatory and binding to us. I think that it wouldn't make sense to have a rejection on an IRP decision, and but it would always be something that could be challenged in a court of law. So I would just like to open the floor for thoughts on this, so we can reach an agreement. Having in mind that we have already taken one question down from the open issues with the possible outcomes. So anyone want to comment on this first open issue? Okay, seeing no one commenting on this, can we have an agreement on at least saying that any outcomes from the IRP would not be appealable under the proper IRP process, and but always, of course, leaving the door open to have these decision challenged in a court of law. I see Alan Greenberg's hand is up. Alan, could you please take the floor?
Yeah, just one question. You've made reference to challenge in a court of law. Who would have standing to challenge?
I would think that one of the agreed parties by the resolution, but I would certainly go back to our lawyers to answer to that question.
Okay, thank you.
If Ed should answer here, the standing to go into court would be determined by the rules of that court. Generally, it would be the parties to the agreement. It is not clear that if you had two parties agree to binding arbitration, that someone who is a stranger to that arbitration and didn't like the outcome of it could come in and challenge that in court after the fact. It would be the parties to that particular arbitration.
Great. Thank you for this, Ed. So that also deals, in a way, with finality of the IRP. And I see Matthew's hand is up. So, Matthew, could you please take the floor?
Thank you, Leon. As we've done before, I just would like to recap my understanding of where we were in Istanbul on these questions. My understanding in Istanbul was that we were considering that the IRP could issue a limited set of decisions that would basically either cancel a decision that was made by the board, or cancel an act, or ask for redo, but not completely change the substance of a decision. And because of that limitation, my understanding was that we were ready to say that this IRP would be last resort, except if we go to court, but as we've seen, it's limited reasons to go to court. So with no appeal after that. And I think there was this balance between a limited set of outcomes and the fact that it was last resort. And I just wanted everyone to take that into account when we try and adjust how we conclude on those items, for at least for the public comment report. Thank you, Leon.
Thank you very much for this, Matthew. I see Kebus hand us up. Kebus, could you please take it forward?
Yes, Leon, I agree with the last resort, but I don't understand the limited cases. Who decide on the criteria that or establishes this limit, saying that this is the limit that you cannot go beyond? Who decide on that limit? Do we establish that in some way, in the article or in the bylaw, or is it subject to the decision-making body, to set that limit? Because it's easy to say that under certain circumstances. But what are those circumstances? What are those limits? So could Matthew Candy clarify or resume discussion at Istanbul about that limit? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kaboos. I'm not sure if this is a question that Matthew would have to answer, but rather our lawyers. So I see Becky is had this up. So, Becky, do you want to react to this?
I guess I wanted to ask a clarifying question of Kaboos. In terms of who decides what the limits are, you know, what we are discussing this would be the independent review panel evaluating an ICANN action or inaction against the mission, the commitments, and the core values provision. So that would be the standard against which ICANN's behavior would be measured. Now, if you're referring to another line, then I'm going to defer to the to Ed.
Thank you very much, Becky. Ed, could you please take the floor?
Yes, I just wanted to. We get into the somewhat recursive issue of the jurisdiction to decide jurisdiction. Who decides? Who's going to decide the limitation of the body? But there is a lot of case law on this in the U.S. because it's pretty fundamental in some ways. I think in the first instance, an IRP set up as a panel would have to decide whether it viewed itself as having jurisdiction to consider the complaint that has been put before it. And then that would be one of the few issues that would be, let's say, that it issues a decision. The losing party now disagrees with that decision and takes it to court and said that process was improper because the IRP was outside of its jurisdiction in deciding it. It should not have decided an issue like that. That would be something that a court could review because it would be reviewing not the substance of the decision but the ability, the jurisdiction, the power to decide whether that decision should have been made. And so that would be a purely legal issue outside of that. It's a complicated area, certainly, and luckily it only comes up in certain marginal cases.
Thanks for this, Ed. I see Susandra Del has a question on the chat, and she's saying that the scope of the IRP appears limited to the parties involved, while the issues raised in any given case would be either of interest to the broader community and or could set a precedent. So what happens if the IRP parties come to some form of agreement that is not considered acceptable to others? What would happen in that case? Yes, Ed, please go ahead.
So I'll respond to that. In a court context, you would normally have, if there was someone who wanted to be heard as part of the process, they would intervene into the lawsuit. And there are standards in federal court in the U.S. for, and it's mirrored in other court systems as well, for whether if you have a stake, direct stake, you can intervene as of right. And then sometimes there's permissive intervention. We could write into the process for the IRP an intervention process so that if one member wanted to take the ICANN board to arbitration over an issue and six other members said, we're also interested in that issue, we could have a process for intervention. This gets down to the kind of the rules of procedure for the IRP on a fairly granular level, but it would not be uncommon to allow intervention, and each of the parties, when they intervened, would be then become a party. So you'd have a, an eight-party IRP process in that scenario.
Thank you very much for this. Let me just draw your attention, and I mean the audience attention, to page 26 on our draft report. That would be paragraph 2 of the introduction, and here. But the working party had led by Becky sets when this IRP would be triggered, and this IRP would be, of course, suitable for determining or challenging an act of ICANN or staff in order to determine whether ICANN is staying within limited technical mission, for example, whether it is abiding by policies adopted by the multi-stakeholder community, or whether in carrying out its mission and applying consensus policies. It is acting in accordance with the fundamental commitments to the community and its core values, and, of course, in all cases, as required by the proposed values. So this is like the starting point of any IRP for it to actually get triggered. So I think that focusing on how or under which circumstances an IRP would be triggered might help us to focus, of course, our work and our outcome. So with this in mind, I think we have so far, I just want to do a pause here to make sure that we have addressed the issues regarding the outcomes and regarding the finality of the independent review panel. And I would, of course, next jump into selection process, size of the panel, and diversity and independence. I see Kevus had a sub. Kevus, could you please take the floor?
Yes. Yeah, very short. You said that the IRP does not have any appeal process. Is that right? There is no appeal process for any outcome or decision of IRP, but I see it quite differently. If one of the party does not agree with that outcome, they could resort to some sort of appeal, whether appeal would be court or be something else. But could you please repeat what you said at the beginning, that there would be no, the binding is different of recourseing for an appeal. So could you clarify, or could the lawyer clarify the issue of the appeal related to the decision or outcome of the IRP? Thank you.
Of course, Kavus. I, of course, would hand it back to Ed McNicholas to address this question. Ed, could you please clarify what Kavus just stated? Ed, are you still with us? I see Ed was disconnected. I don't know if maybe Holly could comment on this, or we can always, of course, wait for Ed to go back to the AC room and the phone bridge. What should we do, Holly? Should we...
Hang on. It's Holly. I have Josh with me.
Thanks, Holly.
Josh... we'll speak to the issue.
So if I heard the question correctly, it was whether or not an appeal could be taken from the IRP decision. Is that correct?
Yes.
So let me explain the way sort of typically arbitration works. And so the expectation, I think, would be that the short answer is that's not the usual approach. Parties who voluntarily agree to bind themselves, to commit themselves to a binding arbitration decision, agree also to live by that decision, whether they like the result or not. And the only means to challenge it is not so much an appeal, but what Ed referenced previously, which is if it's demonstrated that there's some, you know, procedural error, like the IRP exceeded the scope of its authority in its decision, or in the remedy that it provided, then an appeal can be taken. And that's an appeal usually that's taken. If we are constituting the IRP as an arbitral body, that's an appeal that would be taken to a court of jurisdiction. But typically when you agree to commit yourselves, because what you're doing is you're setting up a contractual judicial review process, and when you agree to commit yourselves to that, as, you know, reflected in the bylaws or in other related documents, then you do say that we're going to live with that decision. Now, it certainly is the case that in some situations, people do create appeal mechanisms for arbitration. So if you wanted to write in an appellate mechanism, you could do so. And the International Chamber of Commerce, I believe they do have appeal, you know, mechanisms that can provide guidance. If not, there are others. So it could be the case that the parties could create an appeal mechanism. But if you wanted that, you have to create it up front at the outset. It's not that you can trigger it. In other words, you have to write it in the same way that you create the standards of arbitration. It's not something that you just say, I didn't like the decision, I'm going to appeal on whatever grounds you could come up with. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Josh. Well, I'm mindful of the time, and I would like to, of course, move forward. And just to confirm the agreement that we have so far on with regards to outcome, we have agreed to remove question two. We have agreed that decisions would be final. I mean, they would have no appeal, of course, otherwise enabled by law or by statute. And the panel could only be of the following types, meaning they would only confirm decisions, cancel decisions, partially or totally. And, of course, this follows our previous discussion in our face-to-face meeting in Istanbul. So could we get some kind of temperature here for agreement on these? Could we please signal with a green tick whether we agree on this or not? Okay, I see many attendants agreeing, but I also see many others neither agreeing nor objecting. And I see Caboose hand this up again. So, Caboose, could you please give it your...
Not objecting. Whatever summary you made, would it be possible that our legal counselors look at the wording and look at the outcome? Because it is one of the most complex area of the whole process. I'm not disagreeing. I fully agree with your summary, but I would like that whatever you put in the wording be seen by the legal counsel. Thank you.
Jeff, because of course we will have this put through counsel with the final wording, so we can check that we are putting the right words into the document. And this is, of course, useful, and we appreciate your input. So with no further delay, I would like to now jump. We have an agreement. We have an agreement, and I'd like to jump into selection process, size of the panel, and diversity of and independence. So the selection process would be, of course, one point that we should be discussing, because the selection process deals with many issues. And as it has been discussed, we are talking about a mechanism that, or a panel that would be internal to ICANN. And the reason for having this panel to be internal to ICANN is that we would be looking for people that are ICANN experts, and of course, people from outside ICANN would most likely not have this knowledge on them, and it would finally or ultimately damage those raising the issues in the to be decided by the IRP, since of course a lack of knowledge could have terrible consequences on solving the issues. So with this, I would like to open the floor for comments. I don't know, Becky, would you like to elaborate on this topic with regards to the selection process, how it is depicted on the document, or any comments that you might have?
Yes. I think that we've proposed sort of a number of different and posed a number of different questions. But the notion would be, for example, that we could have panelists nominated by the board and confirmed by the community. They could be proposed by international arbitral bodies, endorsed by the board and then confirmed by the community. And, of course, it could be the other way around as well. But the notion would be that there would be a separation of powers with respect to the selection of the panels, and they would be, you know, they would have be required to have, you know, expertise and skill sets, and largely the group has focused on experienced arbitrators with international law expertise, but familiarity with the DNS and with ICANN, and supported and being able to access technical and other expertise on an as-needed basis. The one thing I wanted to say is that I just want to clarify that I think we may be confusing people with the internal language. This internal in the sense that we are looking for a standing panel of arbitrators who have and then over time develop greater expertise and understand the importance of consistent opinions across time for ICANN. But it's not, it is definitely intended to be independent, and safeguards are built in to make sure that it remains independent.
Thank you very much for this. I see a comment from Greg Shadden that if we could expunge the word internal from the discussion. I see no reason for not doing so. So far as we understand, that this would be a standing panel conformed by members of the ICANN community. So I have no objection on getting rid of the term internal so far. But it would be, of course, an independent standing panel, as Becky points out in the chat. And now I'd like to open the floor for comments, and I see Matthew's hand is up. Matthew, could you please take the floor?
Yes, thank you very much, Leon. Matthew Lay speaking. This is once again to recap what I've had in mind based on the discussion we've had already in Istanbul on that matter. I think we were discussing on a 5 or 7 type of panel that's still in the document with geographic diversity, so as one of the requirements, such as no less than one member from each region. And I think in terms of selection process, we had discussed, I think there was some traction to the idea that there would be a form of board nomination and confirmation by the members based on external parties providing names. That would be the closer to item number 3 in the proposal by the group, where a third-party international arbitration bodies proposes names. The board selects or at least proposes names based on these proposals, and the community group, whatever the mechanism, would be asked for confirmation of panelists. And this is meant to kick the discussion off so we can provide some clarity, because I think these items are very important to be present with proposals in our public comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Matthew. This is, in fact, very important. And I see Kavus had this up. Kavus, could you please take the floor?
Yes, I have seen similar activities in other area, independent group. And with respect, yes, there should be from the ICANN community, no doubt. However, there should be some criteria that they should have not be engaged by ICANN for the last X year before they being elected. So there being, for instance, a board member who has recently left the job after X terms could not be a member of that because he has a close relation, yet his influence or bias by the circumstances condition. So there is some criteria in other selection panels that for the last X years they should not be affiliated or engaged from the financial point of view and from the engagement point of view with the ICANN. Is that criteria is mentioned? I'm sorry, I did not follow that discussion. Just I want to know, because it would be a big risk if someone, as I mentioned, 6 months after the term of the ICANN, be selected by the board and community says, okay, we agree with that, but this may be difficult to prove to be independent. I said may be difficult. I'm not saying it's difficult, that may be difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboose. I see Becky, do you want to react to this? Do you have your hand up? Could you please say-
yes. Caboose's point is very, very important. It is critical that they be strictly independent, both in terms of previous employment or appointments or indeed any post-term employment or appointment. So I think that that is specifically addressed in the template, and I agree it's very important for this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Becky. And, putting back what Matthew said about our Istanbul discussion with regards to the selection process, that this could be third-party proposed names, of course. The board would select and community would confirm. I think that this kind of gives us a bird's-eye view of the selection process, and then we would need to jump to what's being discussed. At this point, and we would need to flesh out the different the different requirements or the different criteria that both the board and the community should implement to have these designations in place. So I see, of course, what Caruso raised is a very important point. And we should be definitely including in the criteria that any member of this panel, any designated member of this panel, could not be previously engaged by ICANN or for a number of years after performing their duty in this independent panel. And I believe that we should also see into regional diversity. I think that so far, well, of course, to define regional diversity, I think it would be logical to first define the size of the panel. In our document, we are looking at a panel of 5 or 7 people, and we're also looking into a decision panel of 1 or 3 panelists. I would like to ask Becky just to give us further guidance on what the difference of the standing panel or and the decision panel would be. So, Becky, could you please explain us a little bit which would be the difference between the standing panel and decision panel?
So, for example, you might have a panel of 7 arbitrators, and in any particular case, 3 of them could be called upon to hear a case and make a decision, and that would ensure that the parties are able to, select, for example, one ICANN might choose one arbitrator, and a party bringing the independent review request might choose another arbitrator, and the 2 of them might choose the 3rd panelist, but you wouldn't need 5 or 7 panelists in all cases. And indeed, in some cases, the parties might want to agree that one panelist could hear the dispute. So we're talking about a standing panel of a relatively small number of panelists from whom a panel could be chosen to hear any particular case.
Thanks, Vicky. So if I understood well, when we're speaking about the standing panel would be, to put it some way, the roster of panelists that would be then called to be chosen by the parties to make the decision, in which we would adopt kind of a panel between one or three panelists, and then they would, of course, decide on the matter. Do we have an agreement on that? Can we move forward and agree that maybe we should need a clarification in our document stating this, as you just said it, Becky, so it's clear for anyone that reads the document that when we talk about the standing panel, this would be the roster of panelists that could be in turn called to form the actual panel and decide on any matter. But do we have an agreement with this size of independent panel? And of course, then for the assignment of the case on this fashion, could we signal with the green tick on whether we are comfortable with going to public comment with a proposed standing panel of between five or seven and a decision panel of between one or three? No. I see some green ticks in the chat, and I am aware that Cavus hand is up, so Cavus, do you want to comment on this before we...
I see no logic about seven. Five, I could understand, because unless you take out the geographical diversity, which I don't believe is major elements. The most important element for this arbitrator or panelist, the professional, it doesn't matter whether they are coming from region X or region Y, they should first be professionally qualified. So I don't think that we could bring political orientation in that it's regional. Then we have to have another orientation that is gender and that is linguistic and that is so on. So perhaps if we drop this regional diversity, then I have no problem with seven or five. But if we impair the regional, then we have difficulty. Even the current five region of ICANN is not a balanced region. One region is three countries and the other region is 75 countries. So this is something that unless we drop any reference to the geographical and diversity and go to the professional and background and knowledge diversity in various areas that we have discussed it, at least five areas, and these five should be, each of which with the specialist in one area, and they collectively decide on the issue, putting their knowledge together on the matter. So could Becky clarify the issue? I remember we have discussed that, but I don't recall what was happened. So geographical distribution is difficult. Difficult to get in that stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Cabus. Becky, do you want to react on this? I have a comment of myself, but I'm not sure if you want to comment on this.
I think that geographical diversity is critical, and clearly that was, you know, why we went with a minimum of five. The notion was that, you know, it might make sense that this is a question for the community as to whether we wanted to have some extra arbitrators around, but you know, seven is a random number. It was intended to, you know, put the possibility of some flexibility in the air, but to keep costs down.
Thanks, Vicky. Sorry, I was on mute. I see Greg Shatton's hand is up. Greg, could you please take the floor?
Thanks, Greg Shatton. I pasted into the chat the language from the PICS panel request that there should be diversity. But I think diversity, a geographic distribution requirement should not be in place, because I think then that trumps everything else. It's one thing to strive for diversity. There are lots of ways to get there, but I think a hard requirement, a la the way that we have ICANN meetings in a rotation of five, would hamstring us in choosing a panel. So it should be part of the mix, but not a dispositive factor as to the identity of any given panelist. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. So I think that a middle point here could be achieved by saying that the criteria for selecting, of course, the independent panel should consider a best effort on providing geographical representation, but of course not fixing it to a set of fixed number of representatives from any geographical region. Would that be fair? I mean, am I getting this right? Okay, so I see no objection. So I would think
if I could just... I would not use the term best efforts. That has a particular meaning, especially when we get to U.S. law. We don't want to, without going into what best efforts means, that's not really what we want. I think a reasonable effort is what we want.
Okay. Reasonable effort. That's fair enough. And, I see Greg is set in all head. I assume it is, since you just spoke. And next on the queue is Tijani. Tijani, could you please take the floor?
Yes, thank you. Do you hear me, Leon? Do you hear me?
We'll hear you.
Leon?
We listen to you, but with a lot of noise and interference. I think your mic volume might be a little bit... Take a look into it, or if it's something in on your side, but we definitely cannot listen to you because we have a lot of noise. Or as Suzanne is suggesting, you could type your comment, or maybe we can have staff dial you out if that's a possibility. Okay, so Brenda will be calling Tijani, and until that happens, then I'd just like to recover what we were discussing, and then maybe the agreement or rectification to our document should establish that within diversity, the geographic diversity, there shouldn't be any fixed requisites to fill in spaces by any geographical region, but we should, of course, be looking into all reasonable efforts to have a geographically diverse panel. Would that be accurate? Could we have agreement on this? Now we'll listen to you, Tijani. We can listen to you as well.
Okay, thank you. Leon. My opinion is that the geographic distribution is an important thing, even if Greg said the contrary, but I think it is important, and there is no reason not to take it into account. I don't see the rationale behind saying that it is not important and we don't have to stick to the geographic distribution. It is something important in ICANN. The diversity, geographic diversity, is something very important in ICANN. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to make a small recap on this since I'm mindful of the time and we're about to hit 15 minutes before top of the hour and we still need to discuss one more agenda item. And so we have agreement on outcomes, we have agreement on finality, we have agreement on selection process, kind of. And we do have agreement on size of the balance document. And one thing that is still standing is whether we want to add wording establishing geographical diversity as a criteria, as a fixed criteria for the selection process, or whether we want to leave this open. And while I agree that geographical diversity is key, of course, within the multi-stakeholder model and more within the ICANN community or the ICANN world, I can see that establishing fixed quotas for geographical diversity in this specific issue could harm the process because if we didn't find a candidate that could have enough knowledge of ICANN and, of course, enough knowledge of decision-making on this type of arbitration processes, it could ultimately take us into an undesirable outcome. So while I recognize that geographical diversity is key for anything we do in ICANN, I would agree to the suggestions that have been made that rather than trying to put language that fixes some seats for geographical diversity, I would incline myself, and this is of course my personal opinion, to having a wording going forward to have reasonable efforts to provide as wide as geographical diversity as possible. And I see Capu's hand is up, and please...
Yes, I think I wanted to say what you said. We could put some sort of qualificative sentence in it to the extent practicable geographical diversity. Because as I mentioned, we have two difficulties with geographical diversity. One is the ICANN geographical, the vision is not balanced for the time being. There is one is ICANN, the other is United Nations, the other is some other organization. All of them are different. And I told you that Asia-Pacific has 75 entities, and one region in the ICANN has only three, so or three or four. So that was done in 1998 because of some other criteria dominating. So I think we should say to the extent practicable, and then we have to find, and one of the constituency of ICANN, GAC, now we're discussing these geographical distributions, and we have a working group to see to what extent is possible. And I have some difficulty that sometimes they come maybe to the other criteria, such as linguistic distributions or the linguistic diversity. We had that in ICANN last meeting for the election of the chair. Some people said that we should have linguistics, some other. So that comes very, very difficult. So we should put, and to the extent practicable, geographical diversity. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Kavus. So I would like now to go forward with our next agenda item, just taking stock of this. And, of course, we have the agreements on the notes section. But with regards to geographical diversity, I think this is still something we need to look into. We need to further discuss this point. And maybe we could go to public comment by, of course, consulting the community on whether this should be something that needs to be put in some kind of fixed seats for geographical diversity's sake, or maybe we should be looking into another into another formula. So with this, I'd like to go back to, I think, Matthew for our next agenda item.
Well, in fact, it's actually me, Thomas. I was going to
I'm sorry, Thomas,
share
the, you're right.
Don't you worry. We will have to talk about reconsideration for the next couple of minutes. And without any further ado, I would like to give Robin the floor. We have agreed that rather than Becky as rapporteur helping with this, we would ask Robin as primary drafter of the template to work with us. We have discussed this during one of our previous calls, so I would suggest that we just go through the changes that have been administered to the template since we last spoke about it. So, Robin, can you please take the floor and speak to this issue?
Hi, this is Robin. Can you hear me?
We can hear you all right.
Okay, great. So on the reconsideration request reforms, now bear in mind that the reconsideration request process is currently described in ICANN's bylaws article 4, section 2. So we will be changing ICANN's bylaws when we rework this process. But actually, the reconsideration request reforms are not a lot, and they're not really significant. They're really just trying to be tailored and narrow to try to address some specific changes. So what we've got here is we've basically increased the amount of time that a person has to file a reconsideration request, the deadline, extending that from 15 to 30 days. We've increased the standing of actions to those that include board staff actions or inactions that contradict ICANN's mission or core values. Before it was only policies. So the key insertion there is really the board staff actions and inactions that contradict ICANN's mission or core values. We've added a bit of transparency requirements, improvements, posting the rationale for why decisions are taken within a more timely fashion. Recordings and transcripts should be posted of the deliberative, substantive discussions, providing a rebuttal opportunity before the final recommendation is made, adding a hard deadline to the process for when the board issues its final determination to within 120 days from the request. One important change would be that requests would no longer go to ICANN's lawyers for their first substantive evaluation the way they currently are. Instead, they would go to ICANN's ombudsman for the first look, who would make that initial recommendation to the Board Governance Committee. And the final determination of all the requests would be made by the entire board. The current practice is only requests about board action are made by the entire board. So those are the major substantive changes. Also, there's a proposal to look at the DIDP, the Document Information Disclosure Policy, and revise and improve that to accommodate for legitimate needs of requesters in order to obtain some internal documents that are relevant to sorting through the issues in their requests. Okay, so I think those are really the basic core changes in the process. And it's up on the screen there now, so if anyone has any questions or comments, they are welcome.
Robin, let me thank you for this concise and precise summary of the changes that have been made. I would like to open it for the group to object to the changes that have been made, as well as to objections to what's in the template at all. You know, so we shouldn't lose any comments that have previously not been made. So it seems like we do have support for this document as it stands. I see Caboose's hand is up. Caboose, please.
Yes, I have no problem at all. The only thing, one a small clarification. What is the rationale for using or taking in paragraph 17, 120 days, taking into account of the number of the ICANN's meeting in the year? Is this 120 days linked to something, or is just taken arbitrarily? I have no objection with the text. It sounds very good, and I have no difficulty with that. But just clarification, is there any logic behind 120 days or not? Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Robin, would you mind clarifying this?
Yes, and I'm actually glad that, Caboose asked that question, because that is a specific issue that I was kind of hoping we could get some feedback on. You know, I looked at what it says now about recommendations within 60 days and then, you know, trying to add on some kind of final deadline on that. So in a sense, it was sort of picked from the air, the 120 days. And so that's why I would really like to get a better sense from people about how long is it taking them to get their decisions back. And so I, this is a point that I think we need to get some data on to make sure that's the right number to put there.
Thanks, Robin. And I guess that's exactly why we are opening it up for public comment, to get more views from the community on what might be the appropriate values to be inserted into the recommendation. Before we move to Mathieu, let me just clarify that I've now called for objections to this template. We will have to briefly talk about how to deal with the DIDP, if at all, in this phase of our work. Mathieu, please. Okay, so Mathieu is just typing in the chat that he was dropped from the call, so we will get back to him once he is back in. Robin mentioned that there have been discussions about touching the DIDP on a document disclosure with ICANN and strengthening that process. I would suggest that in the light of us trying to, or having agreed that we would focus on what is inevitably required prior to the transition in this phase of our work, that we not drop the topic, but that we agree on putting that into the workstream one pieces of work that we will revert to at a later stage. So can I ask whether there's any objection to dealing with the DIDP issue in workstream number two? So I don't see or hear any objection to that. So I would suggest we note that as a result of this call. And Mathieu has just indicated to me that he wanted to speak to exactly the DIDP. So we will not go back to him to hear his view. But Alan has his hand raised. So Alan, please.
Thank you very much. In all the discussions that we've had on reconsideration, the criticism of the current one, that all it looks at is whether policies were followed, and you've added core values and missions. Is that sufficient to do the equivalent of what we have at times talked about, of reevaluate the substance of a decision, whether the right decision was made? Is it sufficient to look at core values and mission, or is there something else that we need to specify to enable a decision to be rethought, as opposed to just seeing whether it adheres to the what is in the bylaws?
Thanks, Alan. And since Robin has put a thought into that together with other members of the work party. Robin, can I relay that question to you for answering it?
Sure, absolutely. And this is actually another issue that where the it changed over the course of the last few months, where we had initially opened it up much wider, and that got such that any decision could pretty much be challenged by anyone who was harmed by it. And that raised a lot of concern for about what does this mean for finality of being able to accept that an ICANN decision has been taken and we can build businesses around it and we can rely upon that and go forward and things aren't going to change. So there was a considerable amount of pushback on the broadening of the scope. And so this was sort of a reaction to that and trying to meet both of those sides of that concern to keep it to or to only expand it to the outside of the mission and core values. But again, if anyone has a suggestion for how we could broaden it a little bit further to encapsulate other things that might not fit within this current structure that we're proposing but wouldn't necessarily drive a truck through the whole process, I think that would be really welcome. Thanks.
Yeah, may I have a follow-on?
Please do.
Yeah. Thank you, Robin. I certainly appreciate that we've always been afraid that if we open this too wide, then it's an opportunity for anyone who doesn't like a decision to question it, perhaps ad infinitum. On the other hand, we have enough examples over the last number of years where large parts of the community felt that a bad decision was made. Have we tried to see whether this change would have changed any of those outcomes? In other words, this may be a better reconsideration policy, but is it really going to be addressing any of the concerns that we've had about the outcomes that we've seen over the last number of years?
Well, this is where I think we really need to look to the community, who a lot of people have gone through the reconsideration request process and can give us their feedback of, you know, would this particular proposal have fixed what they saw as being a flaw in the process. So I absolutely see this concern, but I would like to get data on it, how to fix it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. We have two more hands raised, and we have reached the top of the hour already, so I would really like to encourage you to keep it brief. Caboose.
Yes, I think with respect to the Alan's questions, when we discussed the fundamental bylaw, Jordan and Becky, they put a sentence, paragraph 4, saying that CECWG is interested to receive comments in relation with the expansion of those four items mentioned above. Yeah, if you need anything, we could put some sort of incentive here to the public community that the CWG would be interested to receive a comment with respect to the expansion of the scope of this application. Just calling for that and not adding anything at this stage. But leaving the room for some further comments to come specifically, similar to the bylaw, a fundamental bylaw, paragraph 4 of that section 635 or 653.
Thank you, Caboose, for this. In terms of next steps and a brief recap, my takeaway is that the document presented by Robin can be used on an as-is basis. We are going to defer the DIDP discussion to workstream number 2. There were some more questions that have been discussed in the work party. And I would suggest that, we've highlighted some of those in our discussion, that we try to capture the areas where Robin and team try to get more information in the text of the report to encourage the community to look at those items in particular. And that will for sure also address the issue that Ellen has raised. But for the time being, I think that since we didn't have any objection, what's been presented to the group twice, I suggest we proceed on that basis. And with that, I would like to hand it over to Mathieu for final remarks, and we will not run too late with this call, I guess.
Thank you, Thomas. I think we've reviewed very thoroughly the various aspects of Work Party 2 during this call, and the progress we've made is very, very significant. So thank you all for your contributions. On the mission and core values, we know we have some fine-tuning to do. We've also outlined that we have an open question on how we address the close on the headquarters or principal office. There's a bit of diligence to do on the legal implications on this and whether we want it as a fundamental bio or not, but there's been good progress made. The fundamental bylaw section, we, I think, made, once again, very good progress and are very close to agreement on this. On the independent review panel, I mean, this is still the crown jewel of our proposal. I am very pleased that we have some confirmation of legal feasibility, which is quite good, and I think we have outlined the key aspects of the IRP architecture. So the core requirements are outlined and ready for public comment. And, of course, there's still a lot of work to do on the details and many details and many questions that are currently open with the group. But the way I see it, we're on the right track towards an IRP and totally ready to go for public comment. And that's the same for the reconsideration process, which is very well advanced. So all in all, I think a very, very good day we've had. We will certainly resume tomorrow with some of the open questions as well as the remainder of the report. But I'm confident we are going to be coming out of those 2 days with very significant progress to report on to the community. So I am hoping that all of you get some rest before we resume tomorrow for some of us. Over the course later today for others, I would like to really thank you for your contributions during this first day of marathon, and hope to find you in the same spirit tomorrow. So thank you, everyone, and maybe I would leave the last word to Leon, who has his hand raised.
Thank you very much for this, Matthew. Comment for those who will heroically send on our legal sub-team call that will begin just after we finish this. We need 5 minutes to clear the room, to make some housekeeping on the room. So please feel free to, of course, have a five-minute break. And then we could reconvene. It's 5 past the hour, so we can reconvene at 10 past the hour after staff is able to clean up the room for our legal sub-team call. And thank you, everyone, and see you soon. Thanks.